KUT and KUTX listeners, the stream you've connected to is going silent on April 20th. You're likely using an old bookmark, app, or link that's been around a long time. Please visit kut.org/streams. That's kut.org/streams for more information. If you're still hearing this message next time you listen, there's a form at the bottom of that page that you can fill in for help. Our websites, apps, and npr.org are updated, so you can tune in there. Thank you for listening and supporting our stations.
This is KUT
Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the third weekend of August 2017. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. The city of Austin is collecting taxes from unlicensed Airbnbs.
As the program began to grow, we had different priorities, and the renewal notices weren't sent out.
A proposal to restrict transgender access to public bathrooms fails to make it out of the Texas legislature,
which did not progress legislatively as far this time as it did during the regular session.
And invasive zebra mussels are spreading in central Texas.
It could also cause more of those algae blooms that sometimes make our drinking water taste funny.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. This commercial-free podcast is brought to you by the people who support local nonprofit journalism at KUT. If you are one of those people, we definitely appreciate it. Thank you for your support. If you're not, you're always welcome to become a member at KUT.org. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast in iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, or at weekend.kut.org. We have links. And email me any questions or comments, nathan@kut.org. Or you can ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. If you live in Austin and you want to rent out your home on a vacation site like Airbnb or HomeAway, you cannot do it without the city's permission. You need a license to have a short-term rental. It's been that way since 2012. Not only do you have to pay for that license, but you also have to pay taxes to the city and the state every time someone rents out that spare bedroom or garage apartment. But an investigation by KUT's Audrey McGlinchey finds that the city of Austin is collecting hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes from residents without short-term rental licenses, many of whom have no idea they're operating illegally.
Becca Doberful has a name for her Boulding Creek home.
It's all this rusty color, rusty red. The house is a modern house, and it has a box-like look to it, so we call it the Rusty Box.
Airbnb users can stay in the Rusty Box while Doberful and her family are out of town. Last year, she made $6,000 renting out her home. The extra income goes toward property taxes.
Even $6,000 is about half of our property taxes.
Each quarter, as required, Doberful pays a 9% tax on this income to the city. It's called the Hotel Occupancy Tax, or HOT tax. So when she got a note on her door saying her short-term rental was unlicensed, was she surprised?
Yes and no. Part of me wondered, okay, well, aren't we not licensed?
The city requires short-term license operators to renew their licenses once a year. Doberful pulls out a copy of the last license she has.
Expiration 2014. Okay, my dad died the 14th of November.
And that's November 8th.
8th of 2014.
Doberful says her father's death caused her to miss her renewal. She tried to set it straight.
I sent all the paperwork in, and then never heard anything, and we went along our way of renting our property out and paying our taxes, both to the city and the state.
Doberful remained unlicensed for more than a year. During that time, she says she never got a reminder to renew her license or notice that she was operating without one. What she did get? Email reminders every quarter to pay her taxes to the city. The city collected nearly $900 in taxes while Doberful was unlicensed. So what's the point of having a license program if it's not consistently enforced? After analyzing city data, I found that since 2016, the city has collected more than $500,000 in tax money from unlicensed short-term rentals. That's nearly 14% of the overall city tax collection from STRs.
When I got to this department, I just didn't realize how there was a lack of communication between our two departments.
Maria Stewart is a manager in Austin's controller's office, which oversees city tax collection. The code department oversees licensing.
How does it come to be that the city collects taxes from folks who do not have this license?
Well, the main reason is that we're two separate departments, and Their license is recorded in a separate system than ours.
Earlier this year, the city controller's office and myself began a series of conversations that we talked about pursuing people that were paying taxes but didn't actually have a license.
Marcus Elliott is a division manager with the Austin Code Department.
Those talks kind of dropped off based on priorities that each of us had.
I talked to more than a dozen short-term rental operators who had paid taxes while unlicensed. Many said the same thing. They had gotten reminders to pay their taxes, but never a reminder to renew their license. These tax reminders continued to come even when they were unlicensed. I asked Elliot why this happens.
That's just based on resources. Previous years, when we had 400 licenses, we could do that, no problem. But as the program began to grow, we had different priorities. And the renewal notices weren't sent out. And if they were sent out, it was after a certain group had expired, so that one group didn't get the license.
Elliot says late last year, the city revamped its renewal notice program.
But ultimately, it's the owner's responsibility. They know the requirements.
So then if someone's in violation of a city ordinance, should the city, by collecting taxes, be profiting off of this person?
From a standpoint of a profit, there's no profit on this. What we're doing is trying to collect a fee and taxes for what's being done. It's a cost of service.
This used to be the therapy room. There was a couch there, and now there's not. And then this was the waiting room, and it's a little sunroom.
Beverly Voss is a retired therapist. When she stopped seeing clients in her Northwest Austin home, she converted her office into a room. She now rents it on Airbnb.
I'm on Social Security. I made about $1,700 a month. And so that just would no way pay my living expenses and my taxes. So Airbnb is huge for me. You know, it's how I get by.
Voss currently does not have a short-term rental license. She went to renew hers when it expired in 2015, but there were some problems. Eventually, Voss was told she could no longer renew and would have to reapply. That costs $400, twice that of a renewal. Voss tried to appeal, but says the city had no process for that.
I take responsibility for what I miss or if I mess up, but I think the city needs to do their part too, especially since they're continuing to take my taxes. I haven't gotten a complaint about that.
Do you think having this license program is useful?
I think having some kind of a licensure is probably a good idea in terms of having some accountability. But it needs to be humane and clear.
The city's proposed budget for next fiscal year includes funding for more code enforcement officers. It also includes a one-time influx of $2.3 million. Part of this expansion will be to ramp up short-term rental enforcement, including licensing. Audrey McGlynn Shee, KUT News.
Members of the Austin City Council want to begin the process of renaming local roads named after the Confederate General Robert E. Lee and the president of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis. Council members discussed that this week in the context of the violence around white supremacist rallies last weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia. Councilmember Ann Kitchen, whose district includes Robert E. Lee Road, said she's being responsive to the thousands of people who signed an online petition to rename the street.
There's so much more that we need to do as a city. I mean, renaming a road is a symbol. It's an important, critical symbol, but it certainly is not, you know, we can't just change the name of a road and say, okay, we've fixed the problems in our community with regard to hatred and violence and racism.
Councilmember Greg Kassar also supports renaming the roads. He suggested installing plaques to explain the main cause of the Civil War was the Confederacy's desire to preserve the institution of slavery.
Because I recall myself being taught in school consistently in Texas things that were just not true. And so I think that that is also a part of our history that we should teach folks about.
The president of the United States is inserting himself back into the debate, tweeting out, quote, "Sad to see the history and culture of our great country being ripped apart with the removal of our beautiful statues and monuments," end quote. And it goes on from there. This debate is playing out in our own backyard. Now, according to an analysis by Politico, Texas has the second most number of Confederate symbols after Virginia, 178. And one of them inside the Texas Capitol has become the focus of a debate. Lauren McGaughey has been covering this for the Dallas Morning News. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great, thank you. So tell us about this Children of the Confederacy Creed.
So this is a plaque that is inside the state capitol. It's in that main room when you walk in, and there's that beautiful rotunda with the seal on the floor, and you're standing underneath the inside of the dome. It's actually on a back wall in a hallway. The plaque is unique in that it was put up in the late 50s, 1959, whereas most of the other Confederate monuments and statues on the Capitol grounds were put up around the turn of the century. And it very blatantly denies that the Civil War was fought over slavery and denies that secession was a rebellion. And there's a lawmaker now from the Dallas area who is calling for that plaque to be removed.
And I want to ask you about that. I'm not a historian, Lauren, but I did a story recently where I spoke to about eight Texas history professors. Every single one of them, without hesitation, said slavery was the cause of the Civil War. And just this morning, I was reading an article published in the Austin American Statesman in 1897, a speech by Confederate Postmaster General John Reagan about the cause of the Civil War. Shout out to reporter Caleb Pritchard for unearthing this. Reagan himself identifies slavery as the cause of the Civil War. So I just want to get that on the record. What is Eric Johnson asking for here?
So he has an office just a few feet actually away from this plaque, and he is asking that this particular plaque, this Confederacy plaque in the state capitol, be removed immediately. But he also wants a more open conversation about all of the Confederate monuments, statues, and kind of nods to the Confederacy that are on the Capitol grounds. There's about a dozen of them, and so he's asking the state board, the preservation board, which keeps up the monuments, to kind of take an inventory of them and set a date for a discussion. And he sent this letter to the board, but also to the governor, the lieutenant governor, and the speaker of the house.
What has the governor had to say about this?
So the governor did send us a statement after we published the story about Representative Johnson's requests. And he was very clear in that he condemns all racist and hate-filled violence and says that he has tried to work against that as governor of the state of Texas. But then he added, and this is a quote, "We must remember that our history isn't perfect. If we do not learn from our history, we are doomed to repeat it. Instead of trying to bury our past, we must learn from it and ensure it doesn't happen again. Tearing down monuments won't erase our nation's past, and it doesn't advance our nation's future." So that was the statement that the governor sent us last night. And this is the clearest he's been on this issue. This isn't the first time a black lawmaker in Texas has asked for this discussion, but this is definitely the first time we've heard any definite stance on whether those monuments should go away from the governor.
What's happened in the past, Lauren, when other lawmakers have requested that these Confederate monuments be removed?
So there was a state senator who tried to have this conversation a couple of years ago, and his requests largely fell on deaf ears. He did receive a response about a year ago from Speaker Joe Strauss, who said that he was in favor of putting together a committee and, you know, really talking openly about these monuments. That committee never met. And so it's kind of an open question now about what happens. The governor didn't indicate in his statement whether he would be in favor of putting together some kind of a panel. But the lieutenant governor in the past has issued letters saying, you know, we're talking about this internally. So I think it's kind of up to the lawmakers to see how much pressure they want to put on their elected leaders to have this discussion. Right now, Representative Johnson is making those requests. We know that Representative Joe Moody from El Paso, another Democrat, is going to send a similar letter about having a conversation. And possibly Senator Royce West, also a black Democrat from Dallas, is likely to get involved in the conversation as well. So, you know, this is probably going to be ongoing, and we're not expecting it to die down anytime soon. But, you know, previous attempts to even have the conversation about these monuments haven't really gone anywhere.
Lauren McGaughey works for the Austin Bureau of the Dallas Morning News. Lauren, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Texas Education Agency this week released its 2017 school grades, with a handful of Austin schools receiving a failing grade, the lowest rating. I mean, there's only two, pass or fail. But if you receive that failing grade multiple years in a row, the state can start to intervene and potentially close a school. KUT's Claire McInerney reports on the district's plan to improve the schools during the upcoming academic year.
The good news for Austin Independent School District is the number of schools needing improvement dropped by half this year. Only four received the lowest rating. The bad news? Those schools, Burnett, Martin, and Mendez Middle Schools and Go Valley Elementary, could face some serious consequences. The performance at Mendez Middle School is the biggest concern. This is its fourth consecutive failing rating. One more, and the state education commissioner would have the option to close it. AISD Superintendent Paul Cruz says going into the new school year, the district will heavily focus on Mendez and has already made some changes.
We have new administration, a leadership team is new there at the school. We also have new teachers coming into the campus as well. There'll be a significant focus on literacy and numeracy skills.
But improving academics at a school isn't just about new staff or leadership. Cruz says the most important part of turning a school around happens in the classroom every day.
It really is about making sure that we know exactly what every student has learned or has not learned and focus on those areas. It has to be very, very pinpointed for every single student.
So what does that mean in the everyday life of a student or teacher at the four schools needing improvement? First, the district will appoint each with an executive director. This person is a former principal who specializes in school turnaround and works directly with a principal to develop better teaching strategies. For example, if students are struggling with the skill of counting in their heads and not on their fingers, the executive director will work with teachers to try different strategies until the kids master it. Gilbert Hicks is an associate superintendent and oversees some of the executive directors in the district. He says the important thing for educators at Mendez Middle School and all turnaround schools is to do daily inventory of a student's learning.
We're sure that we're intentional about looking at where every kid is every single day and knowing what we need to teach that hasn't been taught yet or they haven't learned yet. We might have taught it, but they haven't learned, and that's our responsibility to do that every single day.
Currently, the state accountability system is pass or fail, but starting next year, schools will receive A through F grades. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
The special legislative session called by Texas Governor Greg Abbott came to an abrupt end this week, with less than half of the items actually making it to the governor's desk. So here to tell us what happened is KUT senior editor Ben Philpott. Hello, Ben.
Hello.
It was kind of a surprise how it ended so quickly. I mean, it was supposed to end on Wednesday, and instead it just kind of like fizzled out. Suddenly, what happened?
Well, all of a sudden, Tuesday, as the House was wrapping up its work, you had one of the lawmakers go to the back mic and say, would it be in order for me to make a motion to sine die? And the Speaker of the House said, I wish you would.
Wow.
Or something along those lines, just like, yes, I've been waiting for it.
But they only got 9 of the governor's 20 items passed. Right. Why would they sine die so soon when they had another 24 hours maybe to pass some more legislation?
Well, you know, there are many fewer deadlines within a special session than there are within a regular session. In terms of, you know, getting things done. Regular session, a week or two before the final day of the regular session, you can't do things with most bills. That's not the case in the special session, but there are still some deadlines, like a layout rule has to be 24 hours. That's laying a bill out. Printing rule, printing up the bill so that lawmakers can be able to look at it. There are some of those, and essentially we got to the last 24 hours, and there were things that, for bills to receive further negotiation between the House and Senate, there just wasn't enough time unless you suspended all rules. And I think that had to be unanimous consent. And the leaders in the House just knew on some of these bills, they just weren't going to get unanimous consent. So as they were wrapping up their business Tuesday, one of the lawmakers who had this property tax rollback rate bill, which was a priority for the governor to get done in this session, he said, look, the House and Senate don't agree on what this bill should be. And we have been negotiating and negotiating, and we still don't agree. And there's not enough time to talk about it more. Therefore, we're going to stop negotiation, and the Senate can take it or leave it. And then right after that, they were like, and now we're going to leave. And that's it. They adjourned sine die, which means to adjourn without a day to come back.
Right.
And essentially, it was playing chicken with the Senate. Real quickly, the bill, the current rollback rate for Texas, which is the rate of increase of property taxes that a municipality does, if it reaches 8%, voters in that municipality get to go to the polls and vote whether or not they want it to be higher.
But they have to have a petition. It has to be a petition-led yes. initiative. And this would have made an automatic election.
This would have made it automatic.
And lowered that percentage, right?
Right. And so that's the difference. The House said, we will lower the rollback rate to 6%. The Senate said, we want to roll this back to 4%. And there was some talk of maybe spreading it outside of just the largest cities in the state, largest cities and counties, but to all of the state. So that would be a rollback rate for every place. So what the House did is they essentially said, here you go. You want half a loaf or no loaf because we're not giving you your part.
Real quickly, let's talk about what else did not get passed. First item on the list, the bathroom bill.
Yeah, this is, you know, along with property taxes, the bathroom bill, those were the two things that Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick said were his reasons for kind of forcing a special session in the first place with some legislative action that happened towards the end of the regular session. The Lieutenant Governor said, yeah, these are the two things that I absolutely want us to come back and do a special session on.
And he lost both.
And he lost both, including the bathroom bill, which did not progress legislatively as far this time as it did during the regular session. You know, in the regular session, the House actually passed a version of the bathroom bill. This time, the House didn't even hold a hearing on the bathroom bill.
And if you're just visiting Texas and you're unfamiliar with this, it was legislation intended to regulate where transgender people can go to the bathroom, basically prevent them from being able to use the restroom that matches their gender identity in public restrooms, but not all public restrooms.
State restrooms. State restrooms. So
and schools.
And schools. That's correct.
Okay. What else didn't happen?
You know, this session, one of the things that really characterized this session was a push by the governor to pass some bills that would have taken away some local control on issues, taken away, you know, overridden municipal laws, ordinances on different things that they have been controlling, like things on property taxes, like I said, which also didn't pass.
Yeah.
But there was also a spending cap on how much a county or a city could increase their budget year over year. Those things didn't make it out. So while there were, you know, there was a bill that passed on municipal annexation that now allows a community that is possibly going to be annexed by a city, they can now go and vote whether or not they want to be annexed into this city. And again, this is just the largest cities in Texas. And things like that, that municipalities, mayors, county commissioners said would have really hamstrung their ability to grow their community, to protect their community. You know, a lot of the taxes go towards things like fire and EMS and police.
In Austin, I think it's about 70% of the budget.
Something like that.
First responders.
And so, you know, those things, that kind of local control attack that some people would say was happening out of the legislature, that didn't get through. Now, one that did get through, though, it's funny, the tree bill did get through, but it got through in a much more, I guess you could say, watered down version.
Okay, so in Austin, if you want to cut down a tree of a certain size on your property, you have to get city permission, and there's sometimes fees associated. The governor wanted municipalities not to be able to prevent people from doing whatever they want with trees on their property. What actually passed through the legislature?
So the House passed a bill that essentially said, hey, everything's the same. What we're going to force you to do, municipalities, is we're going to force you to put in a program that allows for people to get tree credits, essentially. So, you know, you want to cut down a large tree in your backyard. You go to try to get it approved. The city approves it. But then the city says, oh, and by the way, here's how much it'll cost. Here's the license you got to get from us to be able to do it. This would say that the city has to also offer the opportunity for that landowner to be able to plant trees to get a credit to make up for the fee that they would have to pay to cut a tree down.
Now that we're talking about stuff that did get passed, what else made it to the governor's desk?
You know, there's going to be a lot of talk about how this was a session that could have been much more conservative if not for the Texas House and Speaker Joe Strauss blocking things like the bathroom bill. But, you know, if you look down what did pass, still plenty of very conservative items. There were two abortion bills, one outlawing the abortion coverage to be on a basic insurance plan. Now, if a woman wants abortion to be covered under her insurance plan, she's going to have to buy a separate policy to do that.
Does that apply to all insurance plans?
It does apply to all insurance plans. That point was made multiple times on the floor of the House, that it wasn't just the Affordable Care Act plans on the exchanges, it was plans. Also, there's one on abortion reporting. This is not a restriction on abortion, but is a change in how doctors are supposed to report complications during abortion procedures. And the whole backstory on this is the state of Texas has tried to pass multiple laws banning or restricting different types of abortion procedures. Or I guess the last one was that they wanted all abortion clinics to have rooms like a surgical room at a hospital to perform the abortion procedure. And they told the courts when they were sued, they told the courts, we're doing this for the safety of the woman. The court said, you have absolutely no data that shows the woman's safety is endangered the old way. So there, you don't have a leg to stand on to do it the new way. They're trying to get better data on abortion complications so that maybe they will have that leg the next time. And yes, there will be a next time, the next time the state of Texas ends up in court over this.
KUT Senior Editor Ben Philpott. Ben, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
In the city of Austin is becoming less affordable, and that's pushing more people into neighboring counties. We got the latest home sales data this week from the Austin Board of Realtors looking at the month of July. So within the Austin city limits, home sales fell by 2.5% in July. The number of homes sold fell by 2.5% compared to a year earlier. And if you look just at homes priced under $300,000, the Austin Board of Realtors says double-digit declines continued in July. Not a lot of homes are listed for sale in the city of Austin, and the median sales price is now almost $370,000. So half of the homes sold were above $370,000, half were priced below that. But in Hays County, the median price is $270,000. There, in July, home sales grew by more than 15%, and they were up in Williamson County as well. There's a research firm called Metro Study. They look at real estate data, and they say the pace of single-family home construction in the Austin area is now at its highest level in 10 years. And guess what? Most of those new homes are priced under $300,000. Metro Study calls that the heart of the market. That's where the biggest demand is right now. Here's the thing, though. The top 10 submarkets for that construction are all outside the Austin city limits. They're led by Cedar Park Leander, Pflugerville, and the Kyle Buta area, which is why you're seeing so many people moving outside the city. Now, for a lot of people, Austin is home. But as KUT's Jimmy Moss reports, for many renters, the city is just a stop along the journey.
Almost two-thirds of Austin renters are looking to settle down elsewhere. That's according to a survey by Apartment List. It's similar to the national average, 64%. The reasons renters may leave are many, but affordability is a factor.
You know, long-term Austin renters who have seen prices rise through the roof over the last decade and may realize that if they hope to purchase a home, they might want to relocate somewhere more affordable.
That's Sydney Bennett, a research associate with Apartment List. The company provides apartment listings nationwide and compiles search data in all of their markets to come up with the results. Austin has long had a hot rental market with an influx of young professionals and a tighter housing supply. More than half of Austin households are renters, leaving open the option for some to put down roots elsewhere. As for when renters actually leave Austin, the first place they go may surprise you.
The most common destination for Austin renters within Texas is to Houston, where prices are a little bit more affordable.
Yes, Houston. Perhaps the lower cost of living or a job opportunity drew them away, but the Bayou City leads all Texas metros for pulling renters away from Austin. For those renters leaving the great state of Texas, it seems they're mostly heading west.
Denver was the top pick, followed by Seattle and Miami. So both Denver and Seattle both have hot job markets and a lot of younger renters moving there. So it's likely that people would be moving there for a different job opportunity.
But the Austin rental market is far from dead. The city's mix of culture and opportunity is still drawing rental searches.
Austin was the top pick for renters in Cleveland, Ohio, which I would say is a little bit surprising.
Ohio's loss, Austin landlords gain. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
This week, we learned that the invasive zebra mussels have now made it to Lake Austin. These mussels have been slowly moving south for years through lakes and rivers, leaving environmental and economic upheaval in their wake. Now they could continue their downstream march. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Department announced an established population of the mussels in Lake Travis earlier this summer. And this week, the department's aquatic invasive species team leader, Monica McGarity, said they made it to Lake Austin.
Our summer sampling, we found a single zebra mussel larva downstream near this area in Lake Austin. And then our fisheries management staff went out with City of Austin staff to do some more searching and found a few small zebra mussels here in the lake. So this is something that we're going to continue to monitor the situation. And we haven't yet seen any impacts on the fishery. We know that, you know, this is something we're going to need to continue to monitor, and only time will tell, you know, how bad the infestation will be here.
KUT's Mose Bouchel looked into what we can expect.
When I hear destructive animal invader, my mind usually goes to something like this.
Godzilla's on the move.
But the small striped shellfish heading to Austin are more subtle. All right, so we're standing here just looking at Lady Bird Lake, and I'm just kind of curious, what kind of impacts do these zebra mussels have?
From an environmental perspective, it's, you know, bottom to top.
Liz Johnston is an environmental program coordinator with the City of Austin.
They take everything that's in the water column that we would expect to be there, and they suck it through their bodies, basically, and then excrete it on the bottom.
That will rob other small creatures of food. The creatures that eat those creatures will go hungry, and so on. It may also have a more visible effect. So it could very well be that this water is clearer 5 years from now if they're here?
It may look beautiful to people because it'll be crystal clear and you'll think, oh, this is beautiful, clean water, when it's really not the way it's supposed to be.
That sunlight reaching deeper into the lake could encourage more plant growth, including invasive ones. It could also cause more of those algae blooms that sometimes make our drinking water taste funny. Oh, it gets better.
They live quickly and die quickly. All of the shells will get deposited on the banks. They're very sharp to walk on. They get deep. It'll, you know, make any beaches along our reservoirs not pleasant to walk on barefoot.
The mussels also clog water intake pipes. In other places, utilities have spent millions of dollars dealing with them.
If you have a boat in the water, they like to attach to hard surfaces.
That means from now on, anyone who brings a boat to Austin's lakes should wash it and let it dry, or risk spreading the mussels.
On Lady Bird Lake, we don't have a lot of motorboats, but we do have people coming in and out on their stand-up paddleboards and kayaks that could potentially be transferred into other systems.
So what local waterways are pretty much guaranteed to get mussels? Lady Bird Lake, of course. Decker Lake is fed by the same water, so it's a safe bet. In fact, Barton Springs may even be at risk.
Catfish could potentially disperse them upstream. I'm also concerned about people who swim downstream of Lady Bird Lake at Barking Springs. The larva could be attached to them. If they decide they want to go dip in a Barton Springs pool immediately, they could also transfer it there.
And here's the kicker. There's no way to safely get rid of them. Yeah. Looking for some good news? Well, not every lake makes an ideal home for the mussels, so it's possible they won't proliferate in Austin to the point where they cause maximum harm. Thing is, we won't know that until they're here, and that should be any day now. Mose Bouchel, KUT News.
That's KUT Weekend for the third weekend of August 2017. Thank you so much for listening. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and send any questions or comments to news@kut.org. Our theme music is by RAC. Really, I do appreciate you listening to this. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and kut.org.